chapter 7, verses 1 to 7.
The Lord said to Moses, "See, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh, that he let the sons of Israel go out of this land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring about my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst." So Moses and Aaron did it. As the Lord commanded them, thus they did. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh.
Okay, so God gives Moses Aaron as his prophet. That is, Moses is going to speak to the people through Aaron. Sometimes he doesn't use Aaron, but a lot of times Aaron's kind of an intermediary. It's kind of the voice box for Moses that makes him his prophet. Because the prophets were the messengers, the mouthpiece of God who speak for God. This is sort of a good passage to define what a prophet is. And he says, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and then I'm going to multiply my signs and wonders, and I'm going to bring them out. And everybody will know who I am. It's interesting to me that God has given himself unfavorable odds. Very unfavorable odds for getting this job done. I mean, look at what you've got. You've got a very, very reluctant Moses. You've got a very stubborn and unbelieving Pharaoh. You've got a crushed and dispirited Israel. And you've got a very strong Egyptian nation. Now tell me out of that what the chances are of bringing about a deliverance. Well, very good if the Lord is behind it. And that's what we learn. You know, when things become more unlikely, it just really brings out more the greatness and power of God. It really shows you more that he can handle any odds, no matter how unlikely they might seem. Comments and questions? Michael.
Although there was a special connection, especially because of Abraham's faith, the Egyptians were still his creation too. And it's kind of sad to see that we went from his speaking all things into existence to having to stretch out his arm and strike his own creation.
Yes, good point.
I think Matt. It's interesting how sometimes the more important of two or a group of people is the person who's speaking less. Aaron's the one who's speaking, yet Moses is kind of the one in charge. I think of Acts 14 where Paul's the one preaching, and they think that Barnabas is Zeus. You know, sometimes we think that we got to talk to sound important and to be important. Really, it's the person behind the scenes a lot.
Good point. Yeah, good thought.
It's cool to see in Exodus 3, verse 20, where God strikes Egypt. He stretches out his hand and strikes Egypt. Then in 6, in verse 6, he's going to redeem them with an outstretched hand. And then here as well, he says, I will stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel. The same hand that is going in to strike the Egyptians on its way out is going to bring Israel with him.
God's hand does a lot, doesn't it? Powerful hand. Yeah.
When we think of the great signs, the great wonders that God has done throughout time, I just go to Exodus, and when you look at all these miracles and all these great things that God's done, it's a display of God's power. But it's interesting that it's described as God is stretching out his hand. That's how easy this is for God. He's just moving his hand. And it's producing these great and fearsome and awesome wonders. It's pretty cool.
Pretty incredible. All right, so let's see some of those. Chapter 7, verses 8 to 13.
Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh And thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men of the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He did not listen to them, as the Lord had said.
All right. So he has Aaron do what? Yeah, what miracle? Yeah. Throw down his staff, and what happens to it? Becomes a snake. What a miracle. Really impressive. But how does Pharaoh respond to this? Yeah, he calls the Egyptian magicians and sorcerers. And what do they manage to do? Yeah, that strike is a little counterproductive. You know, they just add to the problem. They make snakes too. You know, they don't ever seem to be able to reverse catastrophes. They just make them worse. You know, now the palace is about to be overrun with snakes. So how do we know that Aaron's gods any better than the gods of these Egyptian magicians? Yeah, that pretty graphic demonstration, I would say. Aaron's snake swallows all the rest of them. And yet, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He didn't listen. Just like God said, Pharaoh's stubborn. And no matter what, he is not going to listen. He's not going to let these people go. After all, who is the Lord? Comments and questions.
I think again on a smaller scale we see that God is winning even though the odds are against him. You know, you have Aaron has one snake and he's up against all the magicians. The magicians have all their staffs and they all turn into multiple snakes, and yet Aaron's staff swallows up all the rest of them.
One of God's snakes is better than however many of the others. That's exactly right. Bill.
Obviously with the point you just made, how did these sorcerers know how to
think?
Where would they have learned how to take his back and
carry it? I don't know. I don't know if this is sleight of hand. I don't know if this is satanic power at work. I don't know. Whatever it is, God's is better.
It's interesting that they can only duplicate so far.
That's right, yeah. The magicians will eventually become converts, but right now they're managing for however they did it to add to the infestation. That's kind of the pre-plague. You know, it's kind of the preliminary sign, but it's really not one of the plagues. Now we actually begin to get the plagues. One of the things that's difficult in this is to really know how to organize this. You know, you've got 10 plagues, that's pretty clear. Is there any pattern in these plagues? I'm going to give you two or three patterns. I'm not sure which of these are intended by the Lord, maybe multiple. One thing you'll notice is that you could group them in threes. And the first in each three, therefore 1, 4, and 7, Moses goes to meet Pharaoh outdoors in the morning. And 2, 5, and 8 appear probably to be indoors when Moses goes to meet Pharaoh. And 3, 6, and 9, there's no discussion with Pharaoh. The plague just comes. So you've got that. So the first three plagues involve Aaron's hand or his staff. The next two or three plagues don't seem to involve any staff. And plagues 6 or 7 to 9 involve Moses' hand or staff. So it does seem like there are some ways that you can group these in threes. Later on, I'll suggest ways you can pair them. If we group them in threes, I would call these first three the irritating plagues. Now, here's another thing I want to say before we actually start into these. And that is, people are all the time trying to come up with some sort of a natural explanation for these plagues. I mean, maybe the water didn't really turn to blood. Maybe it became discolored because of some sort of a natural phenomenon that occurs once in a while. And, you know, when the Nile gets really like that, then, you know, frogs can come out of the water. And so maybe the frogs just kind of came up and they overran things and so forth and so on. And people go to great effort to try to prove that these things can really happen. You know, that there's some kind of parallels in history and that this can really happen. Well, that doesn't really help me at all. These are acts of God. They may be acts of God. He's only done one time in history. He's had a few of those. And so to me, to prove that these could happen in some sort of natural way, this doesn't look natural at all here. These are just direct acts of God. So I'm not impressed by efforts to try to find some sort of a naturalistic process that can account for this. Yeah.
Just when you look at, I'm pretty sure I can't think of which one it is, that one does say God uses a physical means, a wind, to bring in.
He does.
But the problem with someone who looks at the natural thing and says, oh, look, it's just nature. Explaining that nature is a part of something does not say God is not a part of something. I've heard it said basically that you could explain that humans put nails in Jesus' hands, Roman soldiers crucified him, the Jews crucified him, but however, no matter how much nature you put into it, doesn't exclude God's awesome plan.
And we're going to see various details in these plagues, like a lot of the affect only Egypt but not the land of Goshen. And some of those are things that are like, how would that happen? And what kind of a plague only affects the firstborn? You know, I've never heard of a disease that it's only the firstborn sons that get it. You know, there's just things like that that I don't think there is a naturalistic explanation that will even fit all of this, and I don't really think we ought to be looking for it or that it's impressive to us. I think we're much better off just seeing what the text's saying and accepting it for what it says. Roger.
Chronologically speaking, how long do you think, you know, these places?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that. You know, I'm not thinking they're taking, you know, 30 or 40 years or something like that. That doesn't seem possible.
Does it say how old Moses is?
He's 80 right now. I think we find out he was 120, or maybe we find out Aaron was 123. I forget just how that was. I think we do know some things about how old they were at the end. So this is not a years-long process, you know, like several years. But how many weeks or months it may take, I don't know.
So then you would give it probably a year or longer than that? Or less
than that, or? Well, probably a year or less or more.
But not like 5 years.
I don't think so. All right. So the first play, 14 to 25.
The fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them. And the Lord had said, then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile.
Okay. So he says, go to Pharaoh in the morning, verse 15, when he's going out to the water, to the Nile, and take that staff in your hand. And you say, the Lord told me to tell you to let my people go, but you haven't listened. And so I'm going to teach you that I am the Lord. God is giving Pharaoh some help in figuring out who he is. And what you have here, basically, is God and Pharaoh squaring off. They are going to see who really has control. And what does God have Moses do? Strike the water of the Nile and it becomes blood. And it's going to be hard to find drinking water because they really depend on the Nile in Egypt a lot. And actually, other rivers and streams and pools and reservoirs and so forth become blood as well. Seems like they did have some water that they could even dig around and get to drink. But a majority of the water in Egypt is turned to blood. Really difficult situation. They couldn't drink the water. The fish in the Nile die. And what do the magicians manage to do? Increase the blood supply. Been a lot more useful if they'd have turned the blood into water. I don't seem to be able to do that. What do you see as the point of this plague?
God's more powerful.
God's more powerful.
I think we kind of don't realize how hard that would make it. Because, I mean, if somebody turned a river around here into blood, we wouldn't probably think a whole lot about it as far as us suffering. We would go get bottled water or something, you know. But back then, you know, this was a lot different. And they depended on those rivers and the fish to eat. And, you know, and, I mean, that was their livelihood. And that was everything about it. So I think it affects them a lot more than we kind of put importance on it.
Absolutely. God is sabotaging their life support system. Jason?
And he's also showing that he's more powerful.
Absolutely. The Nile was like a god to them. He's showing his superiority to their gods.
Good.
Good. Yeah.
It can also be kind of a foreshadow for the bloodshed that's going to happen for all the plagues to come.
Good point. Yes. Remember how Pharaoh had used the Nile? Throwing the toy babies in the Nile? The Nile sort of turned on Pharaoh now, it looks to me like. Imagine the blow to the Egyptian psyche when their Nile becomes blood. They can't even control it. I think that's probably a bigger blow to them than what we would think about. But Pharaoh turned and went in his house with no concern even for this. You know, you can turn his Nile to blood, but it's not going to faze him. You know, he is pretty stubborn, don't you think? You know, he's a slow learner. Comments and questions. Bring it.
This is like something you see in a horror movie, like an extreme of blood. I mean, it's kind of a scary, kind of threatening thing. God obviously has the power that he thought was a source of life, and now it's kind of like a river of death. From the very beginning, it seems like the Pharaohs have thought that they have the power of life and death in their hands, that they have, it's up to them when people live and die. And God is a pretty powerful demonstration, shows that he's the one that has that power.
Absolutely. Yes, Jacob.
You know, I've heard a lot of people make kind of the parallel between these are the 10 plagues and these are the 10 gods of the Egyptians that it goes against. They kind of make a big deal out of that. Does the text ever do that for us? Talk about God being over the gods of Egypt?
Yes, we will see sometimes when he speaks of specifically he's defeating the gods of Egypt. Okay. So I think that is relevant. I'm not sure we can come up with a one-to-one correspondence between each plague and a specific god, but I do think that several of the plagues correspond to Egyptian gods, and this is a judgment on their gods. I forget just where, but we'll see that in the course of the text. Yeah, Wendell?
God shows you face to face how powerful he is, what he can do in your life, you still reject him. You see how he shows out 10 times and he still rejects you. And today some people are exactly like that. You could show them the Bible, you could reach them every single day and they'll still reject God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is not going to be a problem of God not giving adequate signs. It's just a problem of Pharaoh's heart. I think that's often the case. I mean, God's given us plenty of evidence. When people just refuse to believe, when they harden their hearts, there's a reason. And the reason is because of their stubbornness and their nature. So, yeah, Pharaoh certainly has no excuse for his attitude. Yes?
Not only does it affect their livelihood, it affects their comfort. I mean, it specifically says that it stank. And you can just imagine the lack of comfort, just how unpeaceful that would be. And even with the frogs in the next chapter, he talks about them getting into their beds, into their houses. This not only basically destroyed their livelihood, but it also just made them uncomfortable.
It was a pretty tough play. Bill?
We see in verse 23 where it talks about Pharaoh then returned and went to his house with no concern even for this. When you see not just the stubbornness, but the selfishness that Pharaoh had, I mean, he's probably not taking any concern because it isn't necessarily affecting him as much as it's affecting his people. We need to see it, in our own life, kind of Wendell hinted at that. And when we are being stubborn and we are hardening ourselves, towards God and his commandment and his will, I mean, we're not just hurting ourselves, we're hurting the people around us.
Good point, yeah. Good point. So, Jason.
Yeah, I had a question. At least with eight of the other plagues that come, we are told that Pharaoh pleaded that these plagues be reversed, but this one is not the case.
I think you're right about that. That a lot of them, Pharaoh at least temporarily cries uncle, but he's not to that point yet. It's taking a lot to even give any preliminary indication that he might want them to go. He's pretty steeled against this whole arrangement.
Is this what 25 tells us? 7 days before, perhaps?
Yes.
At some point, it reverses.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I think this is kind of a week-long play. All right, chapter 8, verses 1 to 15.